All right, guys, what's going on? So really excited today because today I'm going to be chatting with Mike Teixeira. Those of you guys who have followed me for a while definitely know about him. I've been following him for a long time. He's got really, really great content, very successful guy in the powerlifting and coaching realm. So first off, Mike, thanks so much for joining us. Like I said, really excited to have the chat. Do you mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background?
Sure. I guess I'm most known at this point for being a powerlifting coach. I started coaching in 2004-2005 timeframe. I was a kind of a cadet in charge of a small club team, and kind of ended up being the de facto coach as pretty early on in my time there. So I learned a lot and learned a lot about training myself and competed myself at a high level for quite a few years. And shortly after I graduated, started coaching people online, and have just kind of developed a system that's, if I'm being totally honest, especially at any point since I've been coaching online, the system has evolved in a way that's kind of optimized for that online coaching relationship. I would say it's optimized for two things. It's that and also the people who are kind of tinkerers like me. I was always self-coached as an athlete, and there's always a special place in my heart for the self-coached. And we like to a big part of the system evolved from the standpoint of trying to help people better understand how to train themselves. When I was, I guess, probably in those early 2000s, early to mid 2000s, there was kind of this notion that, you have to learn what you respond best to, like learn the style of training that works best for you. Well, how do you do that? Well, no one could really tell you. It just kind of takes about 10 years of training and then you just sort of figure it out, and that just didn't seem like a very satisfactory answer. So as I did go through my training career, when I would figure things out, I would think about how can I systematize it, and that's where things like RPE came from, and then later emerging strategies and stuff like that. It's from a systematization of the individualization process of the, it's how do you train? What do you observe from your training that's really useful? And can we teach people to observe those things, so they don't just kind of have to figure it out from, years and years of just trying stuff. Mm-hmm.
And so would you say that's kind of like the broader definition of what reactive training systems is then?
Good question. I mean, this is something that I have just kind of navel gazed, I guess, about for, a long time now. And I think kind of the closest thing that I get to right now is that we're a powerlifting systems company. I mean, we do that in a lot of different ways. Of course, we do coaching. We also teach classes and things like that. But it's about individualizing training, but also creating systems around it, so that, like, the way a lot of coaches individualize training, and I don't want this to come off like I'm knocking it. I think it's a perfectly valid way of individualization, but it's more flexible, I guess. It's more fluid, I guess, is the term. It's the relies on the observations of the coach. The coach has to just see it. I just kind of get this sense that whenever we program higher intensity stuff, it doesn't go as well, so we'll just shy away from stuff like that, and that's fine. But it does rely on the coach, and it really makes the coach's job a performance. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Like, a coach's job is always going to be a performance to some degree, but I always wanted to limit that as much as I could. I mean, just like in your training, if your training is dependent on you, you know, coming in psyched up, rested, caffeinated, motivated every time, if that's what it takes for your training to be successful, that's fine. But if you're ever in an environment where you can't be one of those things, then your training suffers. And like, I'm kind of the mindset, it would be nice to develop your systems in such a way that even when you're not performing your best, things still go well. You know, like I said, there's always going to be some performative aspect to coaching. Like if a coach is engaged and paying attention and they care and they're smart, that's always going to be a better situation. But can you make a system where even if the coach is tired and distracted and unmotivated, because coaches are human too, that you still get a superior result, you know? And so that's the benefit, I think, of systematizing things. And that's why we place such an emphasis on that.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, it sounds like it's a little bit less about limiting the coach's experience than it is like kind of bolstering it through just having a little bit more data at your fingertips, I guess. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that having more data is helpful up to a point. And a coach is always going to be, I would say also that probably the quality that a coach needs the most is just the ability to pay attention to a particular athlete. You know, like, look, you're working with this person right now, and you need to really be paying attention to that and not be distracted by other things. And whether that looks like great note keeping or, you know, something, you know, you get on individual calls with athletes on, you know, something, but you have to be able to pay attention and really absorb into whichever athlete you're dealing with right now. Totally. And so I think that's always going to be the case, but the reality is that just like you're going to have training sessions where you come in and you're not motivated or you're tired or things like that, coaches are going to have days where they're just not as focused. You know, something's going on and they're just not quite on their A game as much as they would normally be. So what can you do to back up a coach in those scenarios? Mm-hmm. Can you have some fail safes in place where you say, hey, this is the process that you use. You know, this is how you go about making these observations. And that'll help the coach make the observations, and it'll also help them identify performance limitations too. Like, hey, yeah, I would have missed this, or, you know, I need to pay more attention to that or something like that. Mm-hmm.
So there was one thing actually that you said that kind of like triggered a question in my head. So in my experience, like, there's always a lot of talk about individualization and customization for programs, especially when it comes to online. So, you know, oh, these tailored programs for you and your experience and your body type and whatever. And but one thing that I found actually is, at least as I gained a little bit more experience to coach myself, I kind of got to a point where I was like, I didn't really have a good answer necessarily. I was like, if you were to ask me, like, how do I individualize coaching? Like, it was a very internal process, kind of like you were saying. Yeah. I didn't have a good answer as to, like, how do I do that? I'm like, I don't know. I know my athlete's doing this, and I know that when I do that, it works, and I know when to pivot, and I know when to do this. And so for me, that was a really startling realization, I guess. And I think a lot of people are kind of in that same boat, whether they know it or not, where they don't necessarily have an actual, like you said, a systemized process of you know, taking information and kind of churning it and being like, okay, what does this actually mean? How can this inform future decisions? So how do you go about developing that process? Like, what does that look like to you when you're developing like a program or an approach with an athlete?
Well, before we get there, I think it's just important to say that like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that process, right? Like, mm-hmm. could you write a paper for me on how to throw a baseball? Like, I mean, you probably could, and since you know something, you know, as a coach, powerlifting coach, or any kind of coach, you know something about kinesiology, you'll probably do better at that than most. But just mm-hmm. take an average high school baseball player and say, write a paper for me that explains to me how to throw a baseball, and it's going to be trash. Mm-hmm. Yet they can do it, you know. So I'm totally sympathetic to the idea that, you know, as a coach, you may know how to write the program and you may get it right on an intuitive level. It's not that it's on an intuitive level. It's tacit knowledge. It's knowledge that you have and that you employ without being able to necessarily put it into words. Now, putting it into words is really useful if you're trying to transfer that knowledge to other people, you know, but if you're coaching and, you know, you're working with athletes, the important thing is that you know how to do it. You know, I find that once you can get to the level where you can explain it, that a lot of times that helps to fill in gaps, and it really helps to make coaches more comfortable with their level of knowledge as well. But I was in a similar boat, and I didn't like that I didn't know what this process was. Whatever this is doing, it's happening kind of behind the scenes. And, you know, it's, again, it's relying on me, on my performance as a coach, just doing it, you know, and it would be better if I had a more explicit process that I could go through to make it a little more repeatable, you know. Mm-hmm. So the process that we use comes from Dr. Anatoly Bondarchuk, who was a Soviet throws coach, predominantly javelin, but also hammer throw. Hammer throw and javelin, did a little bit of shot put, I think. And then more shot put when he got to Canada. But anyway, he's got a few books, but my understanding at this point is that if you were to coach alongside him for a couple years and then read those books, you wouldn't necessarily think that they match up. Like, you're not going to read the book and then derive the system that he's using. You wouldn't like show up and coach next to him and be like, oh yeah, we're doing this and the that now. Like, it's not written in that way. And I don't think it's supposed to be. Anyway, this would have been like, I guess the whole story starts back in like 2010 timeframe. I got an early copy of Matt Perryman's book called Squat Every Day. And he talks about bottom-up programming versus top-down programming in his book. And, you know, of course, the book Squat Every Day is kind of a book that supports this idea of, you know, squat every day. And this was kind of powerlifting's last infatuation with the Bulgarian method. You know, right. Applied to powerlifting, you know, so what I took from it was less about the program and more about like what he was talking about, pros and cons of top-down planning versus bottom-up planning. And like, I understood his points about the limitations of top-down planning, which is basically any sort of planning model that you've come in contact with so far. If it's block periodization or linear periodization, if it's got periodization in the name, that's probably a top-down planning approach. And even if it's not, like your 5x5 programs, like all these programs are all top-down planning approaches, because you start with a plan and then the athlete does the plan. And a bottom-up plan grows from the athlete. You know, you don't have a long-term. It emerges from short-term decision-making. And, you know, outside of, hey, just max out every day and take what's there, you know, I didn't know what a bottom-up plan would look like, and I didn't want to do that, you know. So I kind of got stuck there for a few years. Yeah, so I was kind of, like, I was sold on this idea of bottom-up planning, you know, like, hey, this seems like a good idea, but I don't know how it would look, you know, if you're not doing a daily maxing thing, and I don't really want to do that. So that's kind of where I got stuck for a few years, honestly. Like, it, think about like how to implement, but you know, couldn't get anywhere for a few years. And at one point, I heard an interview with Derek Evely, who coached beside Dr. Bonnarchuk when Dr. Bonnarchuk moved to Canada. You know, actually, Dr. Bonnarchuk lived with Derek for a couple years, and he describes Dr. Bonnarchuk's system in a couple interviews that I listened to, and I'm listening to him describe what they actually did. So he, he's coaching next to Dr. Bonnarchuk, living with the guy, and he describes this system in this few interviews that I listened to, and I'm thinking, like, holy crap, that's what it would be if you implemented a bottom-up training approach. You know, you're allowing the long-term plan to grow out of the short-term plan, and you know, you're removing a lot of the preconceived notions that come with periodized planning and just kind of following this trail of athlete response. And so, like, I began this process of translating this program from this approach from a throws program to a powerlifting system. And that's what we've got now with Emerging Strategies. And so the pattern that we follow with Emerging Strategies is something like, when you start out, you have to start somewhere, and you know very little about the athlete. So you take whatever the athlete tells you about their training history and whatnot, and you do the best you can with that. You design a microcycle, a one training week usually, of something that you believe will be effective for improving their strength. And you repeat that microcycle over and over. And each week you're monitoring their results. And what you should notice is that the results improve on some level. So what you should notice is that the results improve from week to week. There may be a small dip in the beginning or not, but you should see a general improvement in results. You want to continue repeating that microcycle as long as there is this improvement in training results. Then at some point, that's going to top out. And you, like, no program works forever, right? We expect this to stop at some point, and then to we expect the progress to stop at some point. You're following this. You're following the progress of the lifter from one microcycle to the next, and as long as they're improving, you're repeating the stimulus. At some point, it stops working, and when it stops working, then you go into what we call a pivot, and you can think of it like a deload week for right now. And then after the pivot, you would start a new development cycle that's going to be different from the first one. You learn a few key things from doing this. One is that you learn how long it takes for a lifter to peak. These development cycles will kind of have a certain amount of exposures that leads to a peak condition. So for most lifters, I would say on average it's between 5 and 6, but it could be much different. It could be as little as 3 or 4 weeks, 3 or 4 exposures rather, or it could be as long as like 6 or 8 or 10 exposures. And you can manipulate how long it takes by the way that you design the microcycle. So if you're doing 2 microcycles in a week, like a stimulus that repeats twice in a week, then you'll get through those exposures much quicker. Mm-hmm. If you're spreading that microcycle out over a longer period of time, then it'll take you longer to peak. So using that number of exposures is really useful for determining the time to peak and for peaking on time for competitions. But as you do these development blocks, since it's really a single stimulus, it's one microcycle that repeats, it allows you to start seeing much more clearly. Some you'll respond to much better than others, and you start to notice patterns. You'll notice that, hey, every time I do a block that contains pause squats, it goes better than average. Or every time I do, you know, a block of high intensity benching, then it goes better than average. Things like that. Or you may notice things that are a little counterintuitive too. I've noticed a surprising number of people who just don't respond that well to high intensity training. I mean, for powerlifters, you would expect that high intensity stuff is kind of the bread and butter, and that's what most powerlifters like to do. But for some lifters, once the intensity goes past some certain point, they don't get stronger, they get weaker, and they start to feel bad, maybe feel a little fragile or a little beat up. That's not everybody. It's not even most people. But if it's you, then that's pretty important for you to know. You know? And there's all kinds of things like that, different exercises, different intensities. And I mean, as far as the process, and just to kind of show you the rabbit hole a little bit, like, this is what we've taken to calling level one. So level one is about finding the optimal, the ideal combination of like exercises, intensities, volumes, stresses to make a development cycle that you respond really, really well to. And then maybe even two development cycles that you respond really, really well to. But that's all fairly straightforward to figure out. But once you figure that out, then you can start to figure out, okay, what can I do in the pivot that leaves me, you know, most trainable and with most of my strength maintained for this next development block, you know, so you can optimize the pivot. And then you can start to optimize a sequence of development blocks. Like, is there something that I can do in the prior development block that's going to be beneficial for my next development block? Now, the thing is, traditional periodization models answer a lot of these questions for you. Like in a traditional periodization model, they would say, yes, of course, you know, you start out with higher volumes and lower intensities, and you move gradually toward lower volumes and higher intensities, for example. Like, that's one way of answering that question. And that does seem to be true for most lifters. So if you're in doubt, then that seems to be a reasonable assumption to make. But if you're really interested in optimizing this training process as much as you can, you probably don't want to just leave it at that assumption. You know, you can do better than that. So that's kind of the start to finish process. It's also kind of the 30,000 foot view of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. So one of the things that actually I found so interesting that kind of drew me towards some of the work that you were doing and some of the content you were putting out was, I remember, because I've always been self-coached as well, and I remember when I first started out, I was listening to all these people and they were like, oh, you need to do this, and I was just so confused. And it was almost like kind of good, because I didn't know enough, I was like, well, I'm just gonna like make a week's workout and then just keep repeating it and try adding weight, you know?
Yeah.
And I started doing that, and it was funny because the thing that I really liked about that was, because everything was so predictable, one, pretty much always I had a really good sense of, not necessarily always, but like most of the time I had a really good sense of like what was working. I had a really good sense of like consistency, because things weren't changing all the time. I was able to predict like, okay, well, here's roughly what I should be able to expect from today, because most of the variables are kept relatively congruent throughout the entire thing. And that kind of built into how I was training. But the funny thing that I found actually was that I kept thought that I was doing things wrong, like, because yeah. At least to me, it was very counterintuitive, right? Like, you read all the stuff about, I'd see these programs and it's like, they're cycling the intensities and the rep. And I was like, man, I don't get it. I was like, how do you do that? Like, how does he know 70% for 5 reps for 3 sets, you know, or whatever it might
be. Right.
And that was so confusing to me. And I tried to do that and I just kept being like, I just don't get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when people would ask me about what I'm doing, I'd be like, well, this is what I'm doing, but I don't think that that's optimal. I don't think it's good. And I would say that. And it's funny, now I have a very different perspective on that, but it was interesting to see how the current culture or the current environment of coaching really blunted my own ability to kind of explore and be creative, and just like literally refusing to acknowledge that, hey, like, I keep doing sets of 10 and everyone tells me 10s don't translate to a higher 1RM, but I keep getting like 50-pound PRs every single time I do one of these competition cycles. And then the moment, like you said, so I'm one of those individuals who doesn't respond well to high intensity. So for the longest time, I would train really high volumes and then I would never even hit above 85% outside of maybe like 2 weeks before my meet, which is ridiculous, I know. But then I would always have like a huge PR, and any time I tried going higher than that, it just would never work. And I keep my volume all the way through. And it was like everything about me was, I was like, man, this is so counterintuitive. And so I was like, I was always second guessing myself. And I think one of the things that I found was kind of funny was, you know, when you're looking at, like, let's say some of the data that's like, okay, you know, on in general, this is kind of what we recommend, and these kind of heuristics that you see from some of the research and anecdote. And I think those are really good starting points. But then I also think that when you're working with athletes, I have a feeling that you tend to get a lot more of the outliers than you might assume.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that when you have like a natural distribution of like, okay, you know, here's most of the athletes, and you could probably expect most of them to be there. In my experience, most of them tend to kind of be all over the place instead of having like a really consistent average, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get you. And I mean, good on you for having the guts to follow what makes sense to you in the beginning.
Well, to be fair, I was kind of like, I was kind of hiding it. And it wasn't until I actually started listening to you that I was like, oh shit. Okay. This sort of makes it, like, this sounds like what I'm doing, but better, you know?
Well,
and so it filled a lot of gaps into what I was kind of having questions about, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's kind of, John Kiley does a great job of critiquing periodization as it's applied in a lot of ways, you know. We did an interview with him and Mike Israetel on my podcast, and my
I listened take to that. Of, it was really good.
Thank you. My take of John's position is that it's not so much a criticism of the periodization theory as much as it's a criticism of the disconnect between theory and reality, you know. And I think that there are a lot of such criticisms that can be made. And so that, I mean, that's another thing that is kind of operating at the back of my mind, you know, that's fed in part from Matt Perryman's work and John Kiley's work and Derek Evely's work and these other guys, you know. And so as I was thinking about this emerging strategies approach, the thought occurred to me at some point, it's like, how would you train if no one ever told you anything about periodization? You know, like, what, you just know that, hey, I want to lift the heaviest weight that I can for one rep. Like, what would you do? Well, I mean, to start with, yeah, you'd probably just max out a lot, but at some point you're going to get tired of that and want to try different things. Like, just talk to anybody who's ever done like serious Bulgarian stuff. Like, their intuition leads them elsewhere. And I think, well, if you're not told that you really need to cycle and you got to keep your body guessing. And I think back to, like, I think you and I maybe have an advantage in thought experiments like that, because we just remember back to how, since we self-coached from the beginning, just think back to, you know, what were you doing before you knew that what you were doing was wrong, you know? Yeah. And it probably would have been like, well, I'll do this thing and I'll keep doing it as long as it's working. And then when it stops working, I'll figure something else out. You know, at least in a rough sense, it would have taken some shape like that.
Right.
You know, and I think, well, that's not a bad place to start. And we can, you know, systematize that approach. And, you know, if you go, well, you can actually learn a lot from, you know, making things more simple instead of making things more complicated. You know, and reducing the noise in the system instead of making it more than, yeah, I mean, it seems like some clear wins to me. But mm-hmm. It's also a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, it definitely is. And especially when you get so many people, I think, on the other end of the spectrum being like, oh, yeah, this is kind of what we need to do. Because I definitely agree. Like, I've seen a big disconnect between, like you said, the concept of periodization and then application. It's almost being treated as if it's like this kind of fundamental law, which I guess kind of brings me to, you know, another question. There, a lot of the times, like in powerlifting, there seem to be like this reemergence of, I don't know if it's on the way out or if it's still kind of going strong, but for a while there anyways, there was this really big push towards this kind of overvaluation of specificity, right?
Yeah.
And I wrote an article on this a while back. Can't remember for what website, but essentially it was talking about the difference between like specificity and transference, right?
Yeah.
And I know that you've spoken about this a lot. And like, I guess, can you just kind of give some of your thoughts on the difference and maybe a little bit more of like a different, or, you know, I guess how you see the difference between those two things and how you apply them in your own training.
I think that we generally use the word specificity in like the least nuanced way that we could, you know, that like we say specificity and what we mean is like, it looks something vaguely like the competition lift. Like that's not really very technical, you know, like that's not very precise, you know. There's a lot of things that, you know, could resemble the competition lift, but may not be as specific, you know. Like one thing that occurs to me is if you take a more complicated task, like Olympic weightlifting, there are identifiable sub-movements to the competition exercises themselves. So you have something like, you could train the competition snatch, let's say. Or let's go with a clean and jerk because it's a little more obvious. You could train the competition clean and jerk, and that's supposed to be specific, you know. But what if you did jerks from blocks? Granted, that's not the entire movement, but is it specific for the jerk portion? Well, I mean, it seems to me that it would be, you know, and especially if we're going to use this heuristic of has to look vaguely like the competition lift, then it should be specific to the jerk. Or what about the clean? You know, could you just train the clean and is that specific to the clean? Or what about a clean from the hang? Is that specific to, you know, the second pull? You know, well, I mean, I think you could make the argument that things can be specific to sub movements. Yeah, like I think you can make the argument that it needs to be specific, that it can be specific to some of these sub movements as well. And people will say, well, powerlifting movements are too simple for that. You know, no, I don't think so. Like, I think there are still like sub skills within a squat, for example, or a bench press, and especially a deadlift. So at that point, I think what I've found is maybe more useful way to think of it is more in the sense of like, integration or derivation, you know, that you could train something like the competition lift and to use more clean and jerk example, maybe doing the competition clean and jerk is an integration exercise. Like at that point, you're working on integrating all of these skills into one skill, you know, or you could do something like cleans from a hang or, you know, block pulls or front squats or whatever. And those are derivative skills. You know, those are skills that are breakdowns broken down from the main competition movement, you know. So I think I think there's potential for stuff like that, and I think that that's kind of what leads me to think that our conversation around specificity is could be a little bit more nuanced than what it is, I guess. But like, to your point, you know, 100% I agree that like transference is the thing that you care about. And at that point, like, well, yeah, of course, integrated exercises like take in on a one-by-one basis. An integrated exercise is going to transfer better than a derivative exercise. Training all the skills is going to be better than training just one of the skills. That seems obvious, but that's also not what happens in the practical world. Like, you wouldn't just train a derivative skill. You would train multiple derivative skills and also an integrated skill, you know. And the real question is this combination of derivative and integrated skills better than integrated skills only? You know, I think that's a question that's open for debate.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one, because like I found, I remember when I kind of first started getting into powerlifting, and I was like looking at some of the West Side stuff. To me, it just didn't really make any sense, and I was like, I don't agree with this. This is ridiculous. And then like I very quickly checked myself, because I was like, well, I don't know, 40 world champions doesn't necessarily seem too ridiculous to me, you know. So regardless of what I think about it, there must be a whole lot of value there that either I don't understand or something going on. And I always thought it was really interesting how he put such an emphasis on like accessory exercises and auxiliary movements and things like that. Regardless of, you know, what people think about it, I think that there's a lot of value there. And so for myself, for instance, anyways, I found like one of the best ways for me to increase work capacity, and I found this to also be really effective for a lot of my athletes, is instead of increasing, let's say, the volume or the frequency of squats and things like that, maybe having a less specific exercise at first to kind of allow for less accumulative fatigue, and then kind of building from there, becoming a little bit more specific over time, and then eventually, like you said, integrating it into more actual direct squat volume. But starting from a much less specific place, focusing more on like bodybuilding, you know, kind of type training. And I think that's something that, at least when I've explained that to people, I get a lot of people being like, well, why don't you just squat more? And I'm like, I don't know. I just think that it's going to burn me out. And every time I've tried, it burns me out. But then if I do like belt squats or something like that, it seems to be a pretty decent lead up to some of those things. And so I think that there's a lot of like indirect carryover sometimes that you wouldn't even necessarily think about. Like, for instance, bigger biceps, right? On like, so I'm 260 right now, but I used to weigh about 295, and eventually I'll be about 370 ish. That's the goal, right? And so like, I've noticed that since I dropped weight and I'm a lot leaner, just even not having the padding on my arms to kind of press up, I've noticed a big difference in my bench press. And you would never think about that as a direct thing affecting your bench press, but it really did for me. And so I think that there's a lot of these like kind of adjacent variables that sometimes like don't necessarily get acknowledged when you're talking about like the specificity and things like that. That, I don't know. Sorry, just I don't necessarily know if I have a point with that. I think it's just kind of like an interesting like thought that I've had a lot.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I find myself, I guess, being a West Side apologist a little bit, and maybe bending over backwards a little bit more than I ought to for like how things in that system aren't necessarily as wrong as some people think they are. Mm-hmm. You know, like, no, I don't train with the West Side template that, you know, got written about in the 90s, you know. And I mean, I did for a long time, and I actually got pretty damn strong doing it. I mean, I don't do it anymore. And I think there are better ways of organizing training and doing things, but I also don't think that the way things actually happen at that gym are quite as simple as what got written about either. I mean, that's a whole other side conversation. But the I guess more the point is that there are reasons why you might do some of the things that they do. There are also reasons why you may make some different choices, but that doesn't mean that, you know, what they came up with is like, it may not be where you end up, but it's not irrational. I don't think it's irrational. I think that I see how they got from A to B on some of that stuff. And some of that stuff raises really good points. You know, like if you go back, like there's this phenomenon now that of people doing, you know, moderately heavy singles in training. Now, granted, they're in usually in the competition exercises, and they're not max out singles. You know, they're leaving some tank. But I mean, look, I don't mind taking at least some credit for that. Like I started doing that with myself and my athletes probably in the 2000, well, definitely like by 2012, we were doing this. And so, I mean, I think even nobody can claim singles, right? But like, I think I helped popularize it. Mm-hmm. And for me, a lot of my rationale came from some of the rationale that comes out of Westside. And I think the rationale is wrong and also not all that important. The important thing is the training effect, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, whether it works because blah, 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 CNS, or whether it works because, hey, you're practicing your movement, you know, at, you know, high intensities, which is a really great integrated exercise. I mean, the answer to that is important, but it's not as important as, hey, this thing works, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, look, I wrote an article in 2013 that we ended up giving the unfortunate title, Why Speed Work Doesn't Work, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And now, yeah, and I caught a lot of flack because of that, you know, mostly from, you know, Westside people who were, you know, disagreeing. And I think not really understanding what my points were. And the title, which I won't take credit for, was unnecessarily inflammatory. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that my daughter's going to sing a song, apparently. So the interesting thing to me is that if I went back and looked at that article now, I would say that the things that I said in that article are true. They're also incomplete, mm-hmm. you know, and over time I've come across several instances and found several athletes where, hey, when we do stuff that looks a lot more like speed work, they get better. All right. Well, you know, you said all these things about force production, this and that and the other thing. I know. It's all right. you know, you say all these things about force production and things like that. And, you know, how does that shake out with athletes who are getting a good result? Like the things that I said about speed work in particular, you know, those things might be true, but that also has to get squared with the fact that, hey, these people did the thing that, you know, you said, and it definitely worked in those cases and worked reliably. You know, like I've had lifters that when we do low intensity, low RPE training for, you know, reasonable volumes, they get better. You know, they just improve. You know, and that's a fairly consistent result for them. So how do you square that? Well, whatever I said must have been incomplete, you know? And again, like just like the emerging strategies thing, that's not everybody. That's not even most people. And in this case in particular, like with the speed work thing, I would say it's fairly rare But the couple guys that I'm working with now, who that's their reality, that's really important for them to know. And if we were just kind of banging away on stuff because, oh, the rationale doesn't support doing speed work, then that's the wrong answer, you know?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of, I remember Phil Heath a while back was talking about how he likes to eat fish because it thins his skin, right? And I know everyone jumped on him and they're like, oh, you're an idiot. You don't know anything, blah, blah, blah. It's lower fat, so it's lower calories and all this stuff. And I was like, dude is like 6-time Mr. Olympia. Like, I think he knows a thing or two about bodybuilding, you know? And it was like, regardless of whether or not he was right about the mechanism that made him leaner, he was able to identify something anecdotally. And, you know, like you were saying, regardless of whether the mechanism was exactly what he was saying or there was something different, it still produced a really reliable outcome. And it's almost like, oh, there was an expression, I can't remember who said it. I think I heard it on like a Dave Tate video or something like that, but it was like, sometimes good enough is better than perfect, you know, or something like that. And it was just like, you know, if you notice something and you're like, hey, this is pretty reliable, or like, I've got a good feeling that this is kind of going to be a good idea, a lot of the times that's good enough and you can run with that and get pretty damn far with that without really understanding all the intricacies of why it might work.
Well, you know, I think, and this kind of touches on more of a, maybe a cultural thing that we've got going on at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I've seen that same thing happen in powerlifting quite a bit too, like where, you know, you'll have, you know, one of these old guys, you know, and old guys in the sport say, you know, you should do this because X, Y, and Z, and everybody goes, oh, he doesn't know, you know, he doesn't know that, you know, well, actually, heavyweights don't tax the CNS. It's like, look, that's not the point. Like, you're missing the whole point if you think that the rationale that's provided proves or disproves the phenomenon that they're observing. You know, like, just hard missing the point. And like, I've seen this recently, people, and I mean, that's a real example, actually, somebody trashing such and such a method because, you know, oh, I guess it turns out heavyweights don't tax the CNS. Look, man, the thing that people were saying didn't really have anything to do with the CNS. They're just, it seemed like a good enough explanation for what they were observing. And what they were observing was like, hey, when I lift really heavy weights and it's really hard, I feel like crap the next day.
Yeah. So we're coming up on that hour mark. And so I want to be respectful of your time. I guess I just kind of have one more question real quick. So I know a lot of people have some criticisms about RPE in the sense that, like, if you utilize RPE, we have a decreased level of accuracy, especially kind of when you're getting started with it. So percentages are a little bit better, right? And that's kind of like sometimes what people say. And to me, it seems like if you're using RPE, okay, there's potentially a measure of error on the athlete's side, but if you're using percentage-based training, then there's potentially a measure of error on the coach's side. And so I don't necessarily know that one's better than the other. I can't seem to predict very well with percentages. Like, I've done a lot of it and I've had some success with it, but I've had a lot more success with kind of auto-regulating training a little bit more on the fly. Can you kind of give, I guess, your thoughts on RPE training and how you go about getting someone maybe who's a little less familiar with the RPE system, what they can kind of expect going into it and progressing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the objective there is to put the right weight on the bar and lift it the right number of times. And the difficulty comes in figuring out what that right weight is. You know, like if you could look into a crystal ball and see that the right weight for today is, you know, 200 kilos. Okay, how do we get that reliably without the use of our crystal ball? You know, and I think what you're trying to create, the argument that RPE makes is that the aim is to it's to load in some, at some level of difficulty, you know, that it's about the experience of the lifter in that situation. And the load on the bar is a means to an end. It's what creates that experience, you know, so the lifter is lifting as hard as they can and the weight, you know, moves at, you know, a moderate velocity, and, you know, they're attentive to technique in this way, and, you know, it results in these types of compensation patterns or not. You know, the aim is to prescribe an experience, and we use load to prescribe that experience because that's essentially what it is, and to try to provide more detail than that is quickly overwhelming. You know, to me, RPE gets at that a little bit more clearly, you know. But again, if you could look into a crystal ball and say the load that's going to produce that is 200 kilos, then it doesn't matter if it's, you know, an RPE system that gets you to 200 kilos or if it's a percentage system. The point is to put the right weight on the bar. Now, you can then ask, and I think it's reasonable to ask, which system puts the right weight on the bar most consistently, you know? And I would say that the RPE system does that. Now, you have to use it properly, but I feel like that should go without saying, you know, like you don't feel the need to justify percentages in the same way. Like, well, you need to multiply the percentage by your one rep max, not by your birthday. You know? Well, yeah, obviously if you misuse the tool, it's going to lead to a bad result.
Yeah.
So I think the right way to use an RPE system is not all that different from a percentage-based system. Like, it starts from some pretty similar spaces. You know, you use a percentage to get you in the ballpark. You have a target weight that you want to hit for that day. And, oh, by the way, that percentage should also be customized to the lifter and to the lift, if at all possible. You know, the better your target weight, the more fine-tuned adjustments you can make. But that's what the RPE is really designed for, is to make those fine-tuned adjustments so that the lifter has the experience that they need to have in order to get better. You know, that, hey, we can't know that it's 200 kilos for sure. It might be 190. It might be 210. But it's somewhere in that range, most likely. You know, let's say that, well, yeah, that's a 10% range. So that's, you know, the vast majority of your training sessions are going to be within a 10% range. So what we're trying to do is to really nail it down, you know. And I would say most of your training sessions are going to be within 5% of that target weight, you know. But really what you want to do is really dial it in. So if you've got a good target weight and your training is consistent and predictable, then yeah, more often than not, you're going to be hitting the target weight, you know, plus or minus a little bit. You know, I think there's some, before I move on to the other benefits, I think it does allow you to fluctuate for when things aren't going to plan. You know, just like I said about coaching earlier, and, you know, coaching being a performance art to some degree, so is training itself, you know. And some sessions are good, some sessions are bad, and if you can take advantage of the good ones and mitigate the bad ones, all the better, you know. And I think RPE, I think most people do it, you know. If you say you have a session, you're supposed to come in and work up to a top triple, and that's what this 200 is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a PR triple for you. But you come in and you're just not feeling it. You're feeling tired. Everything hurts. It's not getting better when you warm up. Most people are going to adapt. You know, most people are going to say, 200 ain't there today. You know, I'm just going to flex on that a little bit and go to something else instead. That's essentially, RPE is essentially a systematized way of doing that. You know, it's saying, okay, things aren't going according to plan today. I'm going to lift a little bit lighter. Well, how much lighter? Well, RPE gives you a way of figuring that out. You know, hey, things are going awesome today. I want to take a PR lift. You know, okay, how much above plan are you going to go? Well, RPE gives you a system for understanding that. You know, and I think that the mentality that comes along with it is a nice little side benefit that, you know, you're leaving the system a little bit open-ended, you know, gives the athlete some incentive to try, to be present mentally, to focus. It's not just check the box, load the weight, lift the weight. It doesn't really matter how I do because, you know, it's 80% for triples. I could do this in my sleep. So who cares as long as I do 80% for triples? No, fucking kill it, you know? And that way, you know, you can load an extra 2.5, an extra 5 kilos. And believe me, I've said since the beginning that this is better suited for some personalities than others. If you've got this kind of internal desire, you want to add a little bit more weight to the bar, well, then this is ideal because giving you the autonomy to say, hey, if I come in here and get after it, I can load a little bit more weight on the bar. Man, that's a motivating thing. I think for most powerlifters, it's motivating. And I think that's a big part of the reason why it's caught on the way that it has. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm kind of monologuing there for a bit longer than I intended to, but that's kind of the current state of RPE as I see it.
No, and it makes a lot of sense. And I guess one of the things that kind of got me a little bit more interested in that side of things as well was just like, I don't know, my training always had like a really weird progression. Mm-hmm. I'd just kind of be here and then I'd hit like a 40 or 50 pound PR. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like just out of, not out of nowhere, but it would never be this kind of incremental thing. It would be like, I'd be here and just accumulating. And then I would just have this massive, like literally like a 30 to 50 pound PR on a single lift kind of thing. And so the thing that I always thought was a little funny was I was like, okay, well, how am I going to use my max if that was something that I hit maybe 6 or 7 months ago? You know what I mean? Like, is that still my max? How accurate is that? Whereas like the thing that I think has a little bit more appeal is you're kind of basing it off of, you know, like you said, putting the right weight on the bar at the right time and doing it for the right number of reps and stuff like that. But it's a little bit more in tune with where you're actually at right now.
Yeah.
And I like how that can kind of inform, you know, future decisions and directions on training, as opposed to having somewhat of an arbitrary number that you hit in this peak condition at a meet where you have the smelling salts and people right. flapping you in the face and, you know, people yelling at you and women throwing their shirts at you because that's why we all get into powerlifting, right?
Right, yeah. That happens all the time.
Yeah, totally.
especially for us heavier guys.
Yeah. No autographs, please, ladies. So I always thought it was kind of interesting when I got introduced into the RPE and started, I guess, like kind of experimenting with it a little bit more. I kind of liked that aspect of it, that it was a little bit more, had the finger on the pulse, it felt like, anyways, to where you're actually at in terms of, you know, levels of preparedness. But yeah, so we're just a little over that hour long mark. So like I said, I want to be respectful of your time. Mike, man, it was awesome chatting with you. It was good actually chatting with you face to face for the first time. Super, super cool. Definitely got a lot out of the episode. I know the listeners are going to love it. Can you just kind of tell them a little bit about where they can find you, a website, sure. social media, anything like that?
Sure. I guess the social media wise, the places where we're most active is on Instagram and on YouTube. And you can look at Reactive Training Systems for both of those, or Mike Tushier on Instagram. We also have a website, reactivetrainingsystems.com. And reason why you may care to go there is, so like all this stuff I was talking about, especially with regard to emerging strategies, is kind of baked into our website to some extent. We've got a free training log application where anybody can log on and log their workouts for free. And there's a reporting section that'll allow you to run block reviews on your training log and hopefully make some of these observations for yourself. So, I mean, whether it's like a workout planner that's helping you with putting the right weight on the bar for some rep and RPE target that you've got, or whether it's the block review process helping you understand like which exercises, intensities, and volumes you respond best to. You know, the idea is that this a training log should help you make better training decisions. So that's what we've got that we've been building for the last several years there. We're still building it. We've got a full-time web developer who's always working on new gadgets for us to play with over there. So that's available as well at reactivetrainingsystems.com. You just log in, click on apps, and you're there.
Awesome. Yeah, so all that stuff's going to be in the show notes, guys. Thanks so much for watching, and I will see you guys next time. Guys, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode and took a lot from it that you can apply to your own situation to see much better results. I just have one quick personal favor to ask of you. Please make sure you subscribe and leave me a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using. When you do this, it helps me get better at producing content and increases my exposure so I can continue putting out high quality information for you guys. Next, I want to extend a personal invitation to shoot me a DM on Instagram at StackedStrength. I'll help you troubleshoot anything you need. This is literally an invitation to connect with me directly, so make sure you head on over and jump into my DMs. All right, guys, thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.